This is NHPR News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A reporter can take quite a few notes in a half century of work, especially work that spanned 96 countries. HDS Greenway has kept his reporting notebooks in his basement, and they show what covering some of the modern world's most momentous conflicts can be like. Some show signs of dirt, rain, and even blood. Others have ominous notes written in a shaky hand about how to avoid being kidnapped by insurgent groups. There's even one to-do item from a notebook Greenway used in the Middle East in the 1970s to contact and interview a young and then unknown Osama bin Laden. Greenway's new memoir, Foreign Correspondent, tells the stories he started in these notebooks, from Vietnam and the Balkans to Gaza, Pakistan, Iraq, and Afghanistan. This hour on The Exchange, HDS Greenway and a reporter's life on the front lines. And let's hear from you. What would you like to know about reporting from a war zone? What questions come to mind about the many conflicts Greenway has covered firsthand? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post your questions and comments on The Exchange Facebook page. Our guest for the hour is HDS Greenway, longtime foreign correspondent for The Washington Post and Time, a columnist and editor for The Boston Globe. His new memoir is called Foreign Correspondent. It recounts his decades as a foreign correspondent, reporting from 96 countries over the past 50 years. HDS Greenway joins us now by phone. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning.
Your career begins with Time magazine. You first covered London and then some time in Washington. But then you asked to be sent to cover Vietnam after President Lyndon Johnson ramped up the U.S. involvement there. What was it that drew you to ask for that assignment?
Well, I think I thought that this was going to be the story of my generation. And I wanted to be there to write it.
So
I thought that... To just stay behind was—I was going to miss something of great importance to the United States.
And what was the coverage of Vietnam like up to that point? What was it that people understood about Vietnam and U.S. involvement there?
Well, I think we went in thinking we were going to prevent the country from falling to the communists, and I believe that too. I thought, you know, we have to draw the line somewhere, as we did in Korea. But as I stayed there longer, I began to see that it really wasn't that simple. And this was not a black and white communist, good guys, bad guys kind of situation.
Did it take much arm twisting, so to speak, to convince your bosses at Time to send you overseas?
No. I think they were grateful to have people who wanted to go, and they were sending in reinforcements themselves in those days as the story got bigger and bigger.
Now, you wrote in the book that there's a long tradition of a romance around the foreign correspondent, especially the one covering a war. And you write about how Ernest Hemingway would cover the Civil War in Spain. And
yes.
And there's this idea that you're living this fairly romantic life. Is that what you thought that going to Vietnam was going to be like?
Hello?
Are you still there?
Yes.
Is that what you thought that Vietnam would be like?
I thought of all the people like Hemingway and Russell of the Times and the Crimea and all these people who had gone before. And yes, I thought there was a certain romance in the business, and I still do.
Even after everything that you've seen?
Yes.
What
I still do. I think that it's to be in a... Sometimes I thought it was so much fun when I wasn't being shot that I was wondering why people would pay me to actually do this. But no, there's a very good side of it as well as a dangerous side. And it's quite rewarding to get a story out.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the dangerous side. We hear today about reporters who cover, say, Iraq or Afghanistan, and the term they use is they're embedded with the military as they go out into an operation or they head across a part of the country. Was that the case when you were overseas in Vietnam? Were you embedded,
well, we didn't
so
call
to speak?
It embedded, but yes, you would go and stay for a while with a unit and get to know them and go on patrols with them and sometimes in battles with them. But it wasn't called embedded, but that's what it was. The big difference was that in Vietnam, we could get in and out anytime we wanted. When a helicopter would come to bring resupplies and food, for example, we could leave and go back and file our stories and then come back in again when they were bringing ammunition or even helicopters that would be sent out to bring out the wounded. They'd be empty going out and full going back, so you could get out with them into where something was going on. And so there was much more mobility than reporters have today in Afghanistan.
So in a case like that, you could simply start to hear about there's an operation going on in a part of the country, and you could hitch a helicopter and off you go. It'd be that simple.
Yes. And of course, when you were with an American unit, you knew that if you were hurt, they had the best medicine and could take care of you. The South Vietnamese or Cambodian army units didn't have the same backup with medicine, and so you worried a little bit more with them simply because if you were hurt, they wouldn't be able to take care of you as would an American unit.
Was there anywhere that you couldn't go?
Oh, sure. There were lots of places we couldn't go. One of them being in the North Vietnamese territory. And so you couldn't really report both sides of the war the way you can or you could in some other wars. I mean, for example, in the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, you could spend time with the Israelis and see what they were doing, and then you could go across the line and talk to whomever, the Palestinians or whomever they were fighting, and get their side of the story. But you really weren't able to do that in Vietnam.
And you wrote, in fact, in many points, the Viet Cong soldiers were... You knew they were there because you could hear the shots or you could hear the movements, but you didn't necessarily see them, at least alive, in many cases.
Very rarely. Very rarely did you see them alive, yeah. Because you were in thick jungle country and bush, and that's true. Very rarely saw them alive.
What did the American soldiers think of you and the other correspondents who were along on these missions?
Well, at first, the immediate reaction was, what are you doing here if you don't have to be here? And so they had no comprehension that somebody would actually want to be there. And the second was, you know, why aren't you carrying a weapon? And you try to explain that reporters didn't carry weapons. But then they were anxious to tell their stories, and I found them, you know, once you get over that first little hesitation of a stranger, they like to tell their stories.
So it wasn't necessarily an adversarial relationship between the military and the press?
No, not in the field at all. The adversarial relation would be back at headquarters, when often what we saw in the field had absolutely no bearing on what was being reported in the daily briefings back in Saigon.
We're talking with HDS Greenway, a longtime foreign correspondent for The Washington Post and Time, and columnist and editor for The Boston Globe. His new memoir is called Foreign Correspondent. It recounts his decades covering conflicts in numerous countries over the past 50 years. We'd like to hear from you as well at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You wrote that when you saw combat for the first time, your first thought was, this isn't anything like the movies.
Yes.
How so?
Well, the most obvious one was that in the movies, they synchronize the action with the sound. So therefore, if something blows up. You hear the sound immediately the moment you see it. But in real combat, a shell can land and the sound will come a second or so later. And when a machine gun goes off, you can see it jump before you hear the sound. And so that was a surprise to me. I think maybe Hollywood ought to unsynchronize the sound with the action sometimes.
And as you were seeing conflict unfold, what were you doing at that point? Did you have one of your notebooks handy and try to write things down?
Yes, I wrote everything down, and that was a way of trying to get thoughts that I might forget when I came to write the story. So I'd be lying on the ground scribbling as other people were shooting.
And I was going to ask, how difficult was it to overcome that natural tendency that I imagine we all have to not try and run for it or try and find some way out of the situation, just steel yourself long enough to focus on taking those notes as opposed to fearing for your own safety?
Well, it's a good way to not fear for your own safety if you have something to do and try to get it all down in a notebook. Then you're less worried about yourself.
Today in The Exchange, we're talking with H.D.S. Greenway, the author of Foreign Correspondent, a memoir. He was a longtime foreign correspondent for The Washington Post and Time. He was a columnist and editor for The Boston Globe. We're talking about his half-century reporting from 96 countries, including conflicts from Vietnam to the Balkans, Pakistan to Gaza, and Iraq to Afghanistan. After a short break, we'll continue our look at his experiences in Vietnam, and we'll also take some of your comments and questions. You can join us by calling 1-800-892-6477. Again, that phone number, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us your thoughts by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can send your comments and questions through the Exchange Facebook page. We'll be back after a short break with more of our conversation with H.D.S. Greenway. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR.org is your source for New Hampshire political news and voter resources for elections 2014. Click over right now to read interviews with candidates running in the Republican primary for U.S. House, airing all week on Morning Edition. Political news and voter resources are online every day at NHPR.org. New Hampshire weather mostly sunny for today with high temperatures in the 70s. Clear tonight, some areas of fog after midnight. Lows mid-40s north, ranging mid-50s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, welcoming fellowship-trained hand surgeon Dr. Adam B. Fleet to their practice. More at sosmed.org. And from Ollie at Granite State College, classes and social events for adults over 50 who come to the classes and stay for the friends. Info at olli.granite.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today in The Exchange, foreign correspondent H.D.S. Greenway talking about his 5 decades reporting from the front lines. Call in to add your thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. We were just talking about what it was like to cover a battle, to actually take notes as there were bullets going overhead. And I wanted to ask David about, you sometimes sent letters home after seeing what you'd heard, what you had seen on the field of battle, and then hearing from some of the officials, noting that what they said didn't necessarily relate to what you had seen on those battlefields. And you sometimes sent letters home saying that the war didn't look winnable from the American position. Were you able to put those kinds of observations into your reports for Time?
Well, no, you weren't, because my job for Time was sort of report the story and not write a column. So I kept those observations to myself. After the Tet Offensive, however, We were encouraged to get more analytical and try to, you know, inform the readers. But I really think that my boss at Time were having more trouble persuading Time magazine that the war wasn't as going well as they thought. And so there was a kind of struggle with inside Time magazine itself.
To try and shape the narrative and...
Yes. Henry Luce, who founded Time magazine, saw Vietnam as just an extension of his beloved China. He was born in China to American missionaries, and he thought Vietnam was just, we couldn't lose Vietnam as we shouldn't have lost China, that kind of thinking. And we were reporting from the field that, look, this is not going so well. This isn't so simple, and the South Vietnamese government doesn't really have the support of the people that it should for this kind of war, and it's really slipping away. But Time magazine didn't want to hear that in the 60s. So we had a big struggle inside the magazine to try to get our viewpoints over.
What about the military? Were there times that military officials said, we would prefer that you didn't print this, or we'd ask that on security grounds that you don't reveal a certain kind of information?
Well, there were certain rules that most everybody obeyed, and you wouldn't do anything that would give away troop movements, which you know, information that could be useful as the tactical information. To you wouldn't say the Americans are planning an attack here next week or something like that that could get people killed. But except for that, there was no censorship whatsoever. You didn't have to have anybody look at your copy before it went, and it was quite free and open.
You write that one of the bigger difficulties in sending stories back to the field was not necessarily what you could or couldn't write, but what you could or couldn't get transmitted over to the editors overseas. That just getting the story filed was difficult sometimes.
That's what the new generation never has to worry about. They just press a button on the computer and the story's gone. But we had to spend a lot of time trying to get the story out. Sometimes you mentioned these telephones that you have to find a military line, and then he'd patch you into another operator and then another operator until you could get to Saigon. And sometimes the whole thing would collapse, and you'd have to build it all up again. And one time also the line was very bad and scratchy, and you were having to shout. And I finally got through to my office in Saigon, and I said, "It's Greenway." And the voice, misunderstanding, said, "Oh, Greenway's not here. He's out somewhere in the field," and hung up.
After all that.
After all that.
Did reporters, even from rival news organizations, sometimes help each other out to try and get those stories through?
Yes. I think most of us were more interested in getting it right than the competition. We let our bosses in New York and Washington compete, and we'd help each other out.
What was life like off the clock, if that was such a thing? You would file your stories after spending all this time on the phone, and then would you relax? Would you go out?
Yes. If you would go out for dinner and have a few drinks, and then you could go to bed, and you knew that nothing was going to happen. You couldn't get in the paper until the next day. But now, today, it's much harder for reporters who are updating all the time. And furthermore, their bosses can get them on their cell phones anywhere in the world. There were, you know, places in Laos and Cambodia where your boss couldn't get you. You couldn't get out by phone. So you just had to find a cable office somewhere and file your story. So you were much more on your own, less connected with the home office. And today's reporters work much, much harder than we had to do because they have to update everything. Even print reporters have to update for the website on their newspaper all the time. So they were never as free as we were in our downtime.
At the same time, though, I was struck about how you wrote that oftentimes you would be sitting, maybe having a drink with some colleagues or some friends, and the topic of conversation often was the war, even in the off hours.
That's right. We never got away from the war. That's true. Very seldom, because we found it endlessly fascinating, and the story was our lives. So naturally, we talked about it, but it wasn't. I mean, there were lighter moments. I can remember when R.W. Apple, Johnny Apple, the famous New York Times reporter, was the Saigon bureau chief. And there was a UN reception in Saigon. And Tom Buckley, another New York Times guy, he thought of himself as the real writer of the Times. And so he's talking to some UN source, and Johnny Apple bustles up and says, "Well, don't forget you've got to file a story." And the UN guy says to Tom Buckley, "Is that your boss?" And Tom Buckley, as quick as a snap of the finger, says, "Well, only in the sense that Pope Julius II was Michelangelo's boss."
That's no minor comparison there, is it? And so then after a conversation like that, then you might be back in the field the next day as bullets fly.
Exactly.
You wrote about some of the tricks that reporters learn to survive a battle, and one that was particularly interesting was don't walk too close to the guy carrying the radio. Why not?
That's right, yes. Because the North Vietnamese or Viet Cong always wanted to shoot the radio and then the guy carrying the radio and hope to blanket out the ability of that company or platoon to communicate. So that was one of the tricks that you learned. But Saigon was quite pleasant to live in between trips to the field. Very, very different from Baghdad in 2005, when it wasn't safe to go out of your hotel. So I found Baghdad much more ominous and menacing than Saigon ever was.
And you had written about your experiences several years later in Cambodia, that in the early period when foreign correspondents were first coming into the country, that's when many of them were killed, as essentially reporters from the West were still learning the lay of the land. So is there
that's
a period,
right,
essentially, when you first enter into a new period where you operate from a position of, I need to figure out what's going on before I venture forth?
Well, exactly right. And some of the rules in Cambodia were, for example, if you were driving along a road and you didn't see any traffic coming the other way, turn around and go back. Because if there's no traffic coming the other way, it means something awful has happened on the road and the Khmer Rouge or have blocked the road and you'd better get out of there. And another one was if you come into a village, usually kids will crowd around the car because they're curious and they want to see a foreigner. And if you see no kids crowding around the car in a village, get out fast, because it means their parents have told them not to come out, that there's some danger in the neighborhood and you're in danger of being kidnapped or killed.
We're talking with H.D.S. Greenway, longtime foreign correspondent for The Washington Post and Time, and columnist and editor for The Boston Globe. His new memoir recounts his decades as a foreign correspondent reporting from 96 countries over the past 50 years. We hope you'll join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org. We got an email from Rob, who writes, "It is refreshing and fascinating to hear a reporter from an era when reporters were still reporters rather than storytellers, spin doctors, and political activists that populate today's media." And we should mention, too, that when you left Time, you took a job at The Washington Post, which was in its sort of classic era with Benjamin Bradlee as the editor, and this was the Woodward and Bernstein era covering Watergate and the Nixon administration. So that's sort of become one of the benchmarks in modern journalism, that period in the Washington Post.
Yeah, I think you could look back at that as the last Belle Epoque, the golden era of the press, and it's doing its job as exposing malfeasance. I think that I look back at that as a kind of wonderful period for journalism.
Were you encouraged to do that kind of journalism as a foreign correspondent?
Well, less so. We weren't so involved with the domestic politics of the situation, nor in a bureau overseas did you have the resources to do that. So it wasn't like the Washington Post and Richard Nixon.
But you were also in a situation where the critics were saying that the government in South Vietnam, while it may have been anti-communist, was corrupt and ineffectual. And
losing the support of its people. That's true. That's true. And we did report that.
You said that when you were in the field with American troops that you didn't carry weapons.
No.
There was only one exception to that when you picked up a weapon. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, it was in the Battle of Hue in 1968. And I wanted to get back to Da Nang, which is a city nearby. And the only way was to take a riverboat down the Perfume River, American boat, and that was going to go to Da Nang. All the helicopters were full and too busy, and it seemed that this was the only way we were going to get back to file our stories. And as we were going down the river, we started to get fire from the riverbanks. And the boat behind us was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade and started to sink. And the American running the boat, the captain of the boat, said, "Everyone who can find a weapon, go to the port side and just shoot on the bank to try to suppress the fire of people who are shooting at us." And then he'd say, "Go to the starboard side." And I felt at that time that I should do that, as we might otherwise have been shot up and sank. I'm not sure that was the right decision, but that was the decision I made at the time.
So do you second-guess that decision?
Yeah, I sort of do. I had an argument with my friend Gene Roberts of the New York Times, who wouldn't pick up a weapon. And later we had dinner in New York, and he said, "Well, now I think you did the right thing." And I said, "That's funny, Gene, because all these years later, I think you did the right thing." So who knows?
Later on? Go ahead.
Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time, as the expression goes.
We mentioned earlier that in the Tet Offensive, you were wounded.
You
and a number of journalists were trying to help who was at that point a wounded Marine
in the field.
And that even came under criticism from some journalists.
Well, yes, because some said we shouldn't get involved. But goodness, when a Marine is shot in front of you and the corpsman can't carry him, why not lend a hand?
After you were wounded, and we should also mention that you were in several helicopters that were shot down.
Only two.
Yes.
Did
it ever cross your mind to say, "I'm in a rather dangerous line of work. Maybe I could head back to the States and do something where there aren't so many bullets or rocket-propelled grenades?"
Well, I think there's a rush of adrenaline and the satisfaction of getting a really good story that's very addictive, almost like a drug. And it's very hard to go back to the States and give it all up. I was never quite able to do that.
And while all this was going on, your family was, I believe, living in Hong Kong, or at least most of the time.
Yes. In my Vietnam days, they were living in Hong Kong, yes.
And your wife had a a very interesting response when she heard that you had been shot. She got a phone call, if I remember.
Well, she got a phone call from the Time bureau chief, and he had a stutter, and he said, "JB, it's about David," and he didn't know how JB was going to take it, which he, you know, start to get hysterical or whatever. So he was very nervous. And JB just said, "No, you're calling me because David's been hurt, but he's not dead, right?" And he said, "Yes, how did you know?" And she said, "Because if he were dead, your instructions would be to come to the door, not call." And he said, "Yes, that's right." So I thought that was grace under pressure.
And there were, I mean, the threat of death was very real. There were quite a few journalists who were killed in that conflict.
Yes, there were. Many good friends. Just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
And that's...
Of course, you could say the whole of Vietnam was the wrong place at the wrong time, but as we discussed, there were... Once you got to know the territory and know more or less what to expect, there were little things you could do to tip the balance to your survival.
And when we come back after a short break, we'll pick up with our conversation with HDS Greenway about his experiences in Vietnam and his 50 years as a correspondent covering conflicts like Vietnam, but also the Balkans, Pakistan, Gaza, Iraq, Afghanistan, and much more. The exchange phone number, if you would like to join us with your comments and questions, is 1-800-892-6477. Again, that's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email address, if you'd like to share your comments or questions there, is exchange@nhpr.org. As always, you can share your comments, questions, continue the conversation on the Exchange's Facebook page. The book is called Foreign Correspondent. It's by H.D.S. Greenway. We'll continue our conversation with him after a short break. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the expanded U.S. military role in the fight against ISIS in Iraq. Then, judging the credibility of news in the digital age. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. A mostly sunny day today with high temperatures in the 70s. Clear tonight, some areas of fog after midnight. Lows mid-40s north, ranging mid-50s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners. Sim from Kingdom County Productions presenting Northern Border, starring Bruce Dern, with discussion led by director Jay Craven. August 25th, 7:30 p.m., Chesterfield Town Hall, kingdomcounty.org. And from The Telegraph, providing local news coverage and advertising opportunities for today's complexities, online at nashuatelegraph.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a look at President Obama's second term. You can join us with your thoughts calling in at 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Twitter or Facebook to continue the conversation there, as well as nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, HDS Greenway talking about his book Foreign Correspondent. He's covered 96 countries over the past 50 years for The Washington Post, Time, and as a columnist and editor for The Boston Globe. Before we pick up where we left off before the break, we have a call now from Harold. He's calling from Webster. Hi, Harold. You're on The Exchange.
Thank you. Good morning, David, and welcome.
Good morning, Harold. Nice to hear your voice.
Sounds like these two may know each other.
Indeed, for
we
maybe
do.
60 years or so. David, with the benefit of hindsight, perfect, of course, 2020, where you referenced Vietnam and how we got that totally backwards, but really since then through today, we've been getting it wrong. And what insights now, with the 50 years of experience, do you have on that?
great question.
Well,
thank you, Harold.
I think the lesson is look before you leap. I was astonished in Iraq to find out that some of the American officials I talked to had little idea of the potential split between the Sunni and the Shia that's now so obvious. But they thought, well, if we're Americans, so we don't have to worry about that. We'll fix this country on our own. And you remember that General Petraeus in Afghanistan, when he got there, says, well, we don't really understand the ethnicities and the tribal structure here.
Right.
Well, you know, my thought would be, if you're going to intervene, you better understand where you're intervening and what the situation is.
Yeah.
And it seems as a from time after time, we don't do that. We don't try to understand what the complexities are before we jump in.
Is that, David, a place where a foreign correspondent can then play a role outside of a conflict to help the country better understand a complicated situation like Syria, where the good guys and the bad guys, so to speak, are not easily discerned?
Exactly. I think that is the role of the foreign correspondent, and the good ones do this. I mean, there's a story in a recent New Yorker by David Rumnick about Putin and Russia, which it should be must reading for anybody who's interested in Russia. That's journalism, it's absolute best.
Is it difficult to, say, capture the attention, though, of the of an editor, much less the public, if there's a relative lull in a place like Russia and there isn't necessarily a confrontation going on with Ukraine at a moment, to say, look, this is something that's of ongoing importance, we need to send resources there, we need to commit the money and the time and the personnel to cover this story, even if there isn't an urgent story going on at that particular moment?
Well, I think you've put your finger on a big problem, that as soon as it ceases to be page one, we sort of forget about it, but it's still going on. And, of course, newspapers now have cut back on the number of foreign bureaus they have and the number of foreign correspondents, and so there's less coverage than before, but there are some efforts to fill the gap. I was associated, am associated with Global Post, for example, a web site devoted to foreign news, and I think this type of organization will help fill the gap as the newspapers the newspaper decline continues.
Harold, thanks so much for that call. The exchange phone number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Alex is calling from Rochester. Hi, Alex. You're on the exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My father fought in Vietnam in the mid-60s, and he saw some heavy combat, and I deeply admire his bravery. Despite my being a pacifist, I admire his bravery, and he almost died there. And I'm wondering, as a foreign correspondent who has seen a lot of conflict, do you think it's possible, Mr. Greenway, is it possible, and I don't know, for a correspondent to be truly objective, because there is, I think, by nature, a sort of, I don't know how to describe it, like if, for example, a correspondent is embedded with the military, in a conflict, there is necessarily a need to protect certain information so that the enemy side doesn't find out certain information. Then is that truly objective, because one's not looking at it as a third party, but rather from one side or another?
It's a great question, Alex.
I think it's a very good question. I think reporters should strive to be as objective as they can. But, of course, there are some circumstances, as the one you describe, where you're embedded with an American unit and you're helping out, and you're part of the group, and you identify with it. but that's inevitable that can happen. But then you can there are other reporters at the same time, or you yourself later on, are not embedded and are trying to understand what the other side is doing, or a different point of view. So I think, and of course there's certain rules that when you're embedded, you never give away information that can get the unit killed or anybody in it killed. So there are rules. And we by and large pay attention to them, or we're thrown out of that theater. But I think we try to be fair. I think foreign correspondents try to be fair, even if they can't be as objective as they'd like to be all the time.
Alex, thank you for your call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Here's an email from Nancy in Durham. She says, Sebastian Younger was embedded with troops in Afghanistan and wrote in his book, War, about how compelling combat is for soldiers. He discusses the excitement, the camaraderie, and the sense of purpose that war offers soldiers. Could you please comment on this phenomenon and whether you found it to be universal among the conflicts you have covered?
Yes, I was very interested in that. I read War. I'm a deep admirer of Sebastian Junger. I think he got it just right. I think this is more so perhaps today with the all-volunteer army we have today. You remember in Vietnam we had draftees who really didn't want to be there and didn't want anything to do it with it. But I think the professional army today is different in that respect.
Nancy, thanks so much for that email, and the email address exchange@nhpr.org. In covering war, you see that camaraderie, you can see that sense of purpose, but you can also see violence, you can see injury, you experienced it firsthand, and you've seen a lot of death, and you wrote about a number of those experiences. Very visceral experiences, flying in a helicopter with a number of bodies. Is it, horrible as it might sound, is death something that a reporter grows accustomed to in a war zone, or is that not the case?
Well, I think in a war zone, if you don't get accustomed to it, you're not going to be able to operate in a war zone. I mean, that's just what happens. And I worried about how I would take that when I first started out, and was relieved to find that I could put it into aside and get along with my job and not be too upset.
But you said put it aside. Is it something that you could completely
compartmentalize? No, of course, not completely, but it doesn't incapacitate you. Let's put it that way. That I won't say you ever get used to it, but you can do your job despite what's going on around you.
Let's take another call from Evan in Dover. Hi, Evan. You're on the exchange.
Hi. I'm wondering, because I have not heard this confirmed before, but I was in Saigon for 30 days in 1966, and I saw something that I still think is remarkable. There was such a fear of the Viet Cong in the city at that time that they, in the evening, there was a curfew, of course, but in the evening, the army shot a quarter-mile perimeter around the city constantly for about 2 hours until every living thing was killed. They threw up flares, and they would shoot all sorts of armor in that area so that nothing could exist there. And I wonder if the reporter you're talking to had ever witnessed that.
Thank you for the question, Evan. David, you did write in your book that as you were coming into Vietnam for the first time, you saw what you thought was very heavy combat, and it turned out it was more preliminary activity trying to clear an area, which sounds a little bit like what Evan is describing.
Well, what does happen in Southeast Asia is there's a lot of fires lit to burn off the brush at a certain time of year. And from the air, it might look like a battle, but it's really just clearing the land. But I think what the caller is referring to is the so-called H&I fire, harassment and interdiction, which did go on around Saigon, where we would fire shells into an area in the woods and hoping to interdict any enemy patrols there. But, of course, we weren't aiming at anyone specifically. We were just firing shells blindly into the wood. I always thought it just made us feel good and didn't really do much harm to the enemy.
Are there patterns that you've seen that apply to, if not all, the conflicts and wars you've covered, but that you see commonalities? You would see something, say, in Afghanistan, and you would say, this reminds me of something I saw in Vietnam or something I saw in Cambodia.
Yes. And Sebastian Junger, in that same book that your caller mentioned, said about his experience in Afghanistan that the officials, American officials briefing him, weren't trying to lie to him or deceive him. They were inviting him to join a conspiracy of wishful thinking. And I've seen again and again and again this wishful thinking as American officials who were sent there to do a good job, and they let their enthusiasm blind them to what's really going on.
And what is the job then of a foreign correspondent hearing what is discordant with what they're seeing and experiencing in combat
zones? Well, to try to tell the reader that everything that is being said in the briefing isn't just so. That's why we all call the briefings in Saigon the 5 o'clock follies, because they so seldom reflected what we had seen going on in the field. It's not the fault of the briefers. It's just that this wishful thinking takes over, and they try to emphasize the positive and play down the negative and put as good face on it as they can.
There are foreign correspondents, of course, in conflict zones all over the world today. And as they look back on their careers, maybe decades from now, are they going to carry with them the same lessons, do you think, that you have learned from your experiences?
I suspect they will. I think there are certain universal things that don't change that much from war to war. But I will say today's correspondents have to work a great deal harder than we do. I mean, we could, you know, put a story to bed and have a good meal and relax. And today's reporter always has to, 24-hour news cycle, they have to keep updating. And even the print journalists have to update for the internet. So it's a much more intense and time-consuming process than when I was in the field.
And if you're saying that there are certain things that don't seem to change from war to war to war, that sounds fairly discouraging. We'd like to think that we're making progress as society, and maybe not always the case.
Well, I see these similarities between what I learned in Vietnam and I saw in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and I see some of the same mistakes. One of them is that we always automatically assume that everyone should be just like an American, that if everyone in their natural state would want to be an American, and we sort of take that as granted, that they want the same democracy that we have, and many people do. But it isn't quite the same democracy as we have or the same way of looking at it. And I had a very interesting interview with a Russian ambassador in Afghanistan a few years ago, where he had been a young Foreign Service officer in Kabul in Afghanistan as a young man, and now he was back as an ambassador. And he said, you know, we made the same mistake. We thought everyone would want to be a communist and want to be a Russian just like us. And we thought that we were saving, we really thought we were saving these people from Islamic fundamentalism, and we thought we were helping them. But then as time came by, we realized that Afghans don't take kindly to foreigners coming in and telling them what to do.
Last question for you quickly. You've talked about the excitement and the romance of this kind of work, and you also say that it took a toll on you at times. If you had the choice, would you still ask Time Magazine to send you to Vietnam all over again?
I would. It was a wonderful time, and I would do the same thing all over again.
Well, David, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That's H.D.S. Greenway, longtime foreign correspondent for The Washington Post and Time, and columnist and editor for The Boston Globe. His memoir is called Foreign Correspondent. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. And our producer is Faith Meixel. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
The Exchange. It gets New Hampshire talking, whether it's schools or alternative fuels, the economy or astronomy, transportation, immigration, or what it means to be first in the nation. It's been said that the public interest is best served by the free exchange of ideas. I'm Laura Kanoi. Be part of our exchange, weekday mornings at 9, here on NHPR.
Ian Ream Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio. New Hampshire weather, mostly sunny for today, highs in the 70s. Clear tonight, some areas of fog after midnight, low temperatures mid-40s north, ranging mid-50s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from your listeners, and support also comes to us from Loon Mountain Resort, offering you a whole day of family mountain fun with 10 adventures included in the Super Adventure Pass. Details at loonmtn.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Iraqi and Kurdish forces, with help from U.S. jets, drones, and bombers, recaptured a strategically important dam in northern Iraq from ISIS militants. In his speech yesterday, President Obama hailed the effort. He said the two-day ground offensive demonstrated the cooperation possible between Kurdish and Iraqi forces. He said the U.S. would continue air support for these joint efforts. The territorial ambitions of ISIS are far-reaching and represent, many believe, a dire threat to security in the region, Europe, and the U.S. The fight against ISIS, the future of Iraq, and the U.S. role in the region. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Overnight protests have quieted in Ferguson, Missouri, but earlier demonstrations were loud in the St. Louis suburb as some protesters clashed with police. Missouri Highway Patrol Captain Ron Johnson is in command in Ferguson. He says a small number of criminals hid in crowds of lawful protesters and several people were detained.
As of 2 a.m., 31 people have been arrested tonight. I've said that many of the criminal element that have been coming to Ferguson are not from this area. Tonight, some of those arrested came from as far as away as New York and California.
Johnson said that police were shot at in the protests, but did not return fire. He asked Ferguson protesters to continue their demonstrations during the day, citing a, quote, dangerous dynamic in the night. The mother of slain teenager Michael Brown says the protests that turned violent are a distraction. Leslie McSpadden says instead she wants police officer Darren Wilson, who shot her son, to face justice.
Him being arrested, charges being filed, and a prosecution. Him being held accountable for what he did.
She spoke to NBC's Today Show. The Israeli military says three rockets have been fired toward Israel from Gaza. The firing breaks a temporary ceasefire between Israel and Palestinians.